football on Off the Ball.
If you want to approach life well, with hunger, with an intellectual curiosity, be Martin O'Neill.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Good evening and welcome along to Monday Night's Off the Ball. We're on your radios until 10 o'clock tonight. And coming up, we're going to be speaking to Darren O'Sullivan from 8pm, talking all things Gaelic football. Monday Night Rugby with Mike Sherry is coming your way from around 8:30. And then on the football show between 9 and 10, Kevin Kilbane will join us to reflect on the weekend's Premier League action. Our number is 087-9180-180. If you've got any weekend thoughts from the sporting action over the past 48 hours or so, you can WhatsApp us. Stephen Doyle is here in studio with us. Michael McCarthy is here. Hello, Mick.
Hi, Owen. How are you?
And Arthur O'Dea has decided that he's had enough of those 3:30 a.m. alarms. And he says, I want a lie-in on a Monday. I want to get up at midday. I want to be having my lunch for breakfast. And I want to join the PM team. Arthur O'Dea, you are very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
How has day one treated
beautiful,
you so far?
Beautiful morning.
What did you do for the morning, your first free morning in quite some time?
Just listen to the radio, very relaxing, looking through the different sports news, whatever was going on. It was lovely. It was very relaxed. Couldn't recommend it highly enough. Can't believe you didn't do it sooner.
Well, there you go. It sounds like a very peaceful couple of hours to start the day. You're very, very welcome. Great to have you on board. To start things on a positive note, it's very obvious that if you go online, if you do any, you know, listening to radio or looking at any sports news, as you were doing this morning, Arthur, everybody is unbelievably angry and possibly more angry than they've ever been, whether it's anger with VAR and officiating, anger with grappling in the box, anger with Arsenal's methods to try and hoist the Premier League trophy for the first time in 22 years. And then there's anger from Arsenal fans at the anger that's being shown towards them for the way in which they're going about trying to hoist their first Premier League trophy in 22 years. Everybody is furious. I think this actually might be the most maddening Premier League title race that we've ever had. And I mean that in a literal sense. I think that football discourse has gone crazy. Everybody is just furious with how things played out yesterday.
The worse the world gets and the scarier the world gets, you would think it would almost go the other way.
A bam almost.
Like, let's just enjoy what we have. It's only football. Let's get into it for what it is and turn it off once it's over and forget about it. But I think you're right. It's gone the complete opposite way. Everyone's lost their collective minds. Just constant arguing. Now, it is hard to watch. Which is
an abomination.
You've given it 2 hours of your life to just watch lads run into each other. And, the old in-swinger. Like, God, Steve Staunton would have a field day in this day and age, wouldn't he? He'd be the best. He'd be the Rory Delap of his age. He'd be the most important player in the Premier League right now if he was still playing.
And Rory Delap would be
thrown in from one side and Stan would be hitting the in-swingers from the other side.
I love how, Arthur, your first piece of analysis on the show is an abomination. You've gone in hard, two-footed on this. Go on, give it to us.
It's just really tough to watch, isn't it? Just when you think of that game, it's like three set pieces and you're thinking that's not even unusual. Look, there's something to set pieces, but it is the constant. I often wonder how much of it's just kind of I don't think echo chamber is the correct thing, but you know when you're just something so repetitive that you just end up self-fulfilling prophecy, that type of thing, that we're so geared towards it now, and then it's like that happens. You're like, all three goals coming from it. You're like, come on, it can't literally be like this, because I feel like some of it's probably exaggerated, the extent to which they're so one-dimensional or whatever else, that they're not actually that bad. But then on the big day, it is so unfulfilling to watch.
Like, it wasn't as bad as United-Everton last week. You were commentating on Devo, obviously. But it did feel like there is something to be said for when the league leaders are playing another big team and it's Sunday 4:30, that I'm getting less and less excited about them every week. And they'll take the anger out of it and the over-the-top reaction. That is important. I think that does hurt.
Okay, can I just add, I find it fascinating that it's going less and less every week.
I'm more and more intrigued by the storyline
exactly,
and everything that, like that. But the actual
that exists.
Sitting down for the 90 minutes is tough.
But the storyline exists parallel to watching the football.
Absolutely,
the storyline matters. That is why a lot of us love sport. It takes it to a higher plane. It gives us greater understanding of why what we're watching is important. And the storyline is incredible right now. We are witnessing cracks in this title charge, where a situation exists that Arsenal should be 9 points clear at this point, 10 points clear at this point, and they're not. They have cracked on so many occasions, and we are watching this unfold live every single week. And yesterday was another chapter, so nearly another chapter of them showing further cracks and bottling this title challenge. I just find that a fascinating narrative, and I don't understand how we've suddenly divorced that, and we're just looking at this singularly through the prism of Arsenal and their set pieces. Because the other thing to say about this, even if you hate Arsenal, is that they've
so defensive.
They've been so bad from open play, and even the people. I'm not being defensive at all. But like, nobody's talking about this.
What's optimal Arsenal? Because the way I see it, yesterday wasn't like a drop off or whatever. It's like that's them performing as they want to perform. What's, you know, the thing you were talking about, like it should be captivating because there's a bit of cracks, right? But the crack suggests a beautiful hole. I don't think Arsenal have the beautiful hole that you're having the cracks from, that you're like, don't do that, WH.
Yeah.
That you don't have the thing coming from. What's it coming out of? You know what I mean? What are you missing? You know, well, the way of City or
it all changed a couple of seasons ago when Arsenal played that famous game up at the Etihad Stadium a couple of seasons ago, and they went up and they decided to play very defensively, not to give away anything and to come away with there with at least a point. And I think that's kind of been the turning point.
The start of last season. When John Stones scored a late equaliser.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, the start of last season. So it all kind of went, I think it all started going, like stylistically it started going downhill from there for Arsenal. They're not pleasant to watch. I'm just like, you know, Manchester City are more entertaining to watch at the moment, and I used to get really bored watching Manchester City a few seasons back because they just tried to pass teams to death, get the ball at the end line, pull it back and put the ball into the back of the net. And it was just really, really boring. Whereas Man City now have become this really, like they've got a couple of, I suppose what you would call maybe tricky playmakers. They've got Erling Haaland, who's killing himself to be in both boxes nearly at the same time. And they are, you know, a team that is not without its faults, and that makes it exciting to see them playing. And Elland Road on Saturday night, like, that's such a hard fixture for any team. As we've seen throughout the season, if you play Leeds United at 5:30 on a Saturday night,
it's a tough place to go.
I didn't want to say tough place to go.
Yeah.
But can I just say on the grappling stuff, like, I was doing that game yesterday with Keith, and the Declan Rice penalty thing, they're looking at the Declan Rice penalty thing, and that's fair enough, you know, but you're kind of going, sorry, is nobody else looking at all these players rugby tackling each other inside the box at the same time? And then, oh wait, let's have a look to see if João Pedro got bopped in the head by the goalkeeper. And it's like, yeah, he does, but look, everybody is bloody pulling the bejesus out of each other. It reminded me of, I thought about Howard Webb came out last August, right? Last August, the start of this season, and this is what he said. Howard Webb, who's obviously the head of the PGMOL, so he wants to get tough last August on players grappling with each other in the box, and he announces a crackdown. I would expect to see a few more penalties given, Webb said. What we said to the officials is, if you get one of those situations where one player is clearly dragging another one to the floor in an extreme non-footballing action, even if it's off the ball, we expect either the referee to see it, or if it's a clear one, then the VAR will intervene and recommend the referee looks at it at the screen because it fits the criteria we've laid out. This is not going to be a 6-week campaign and then we forget all about it. We have to identify those situations that do fall in line with the feedback we've had, and that there's just too many examples of players clearly pulling people back, impacting their ability to move to the ball or some clear extreme actions that are not being penalised.
Okay, so you're saying
it clearly was a 6-week campaign.
It was like, 6 weeks, my arse.
Come on.
6 days, maybe.
But I don't even remember that being a short-term thing. I don't remember there being a slew of penalties last season. We had the slew of penalties, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, when they went right. I can't even remember what infringements they were cracking down on. But I don't even remember that crackdown.
Well, there was a match last season involving Newcastle United. And I remember, they either conceded a penalty or had a player sent off. And it was like out of the blue, and it was at the start of the last season, and everybody's like, "Oh my God, this is unbelievable! Like they've never done this." And it was like, "Oh, this is the, you know, Premier League referees setting a deal." Now, look, I do feel sorry for referees, because you see stuff like yesterday, like Cunha going down with the feather touch, and Harry Maguire. Oh my, that slow motion of Harry Maguire with Larson's foot going towards his head. And Maguire heads the ball and starts going out. And I'm like, if Larson actually made contact with Maguire's head, he probably would have sprained his ankle. Come on, like.
Do you think Maguire imagined it? Like, because it was, just, he felt it coming, you know, and then, anyway.
It was just a reflex.
The point of the, I agree that, like, and we can be tiresome on referees, and I know that Arthur and Owen, you don't love referees chat and stuff. It's fine, like, I completely get where you're coming from. But it is maddening. If we're going to commit ourselves to caring about this nonsense that is the Premier League, right, and it is football, right, and we're going to get, you know, invested in it, the inconsistency. And it's not refereeing decisions, because that can be, that's flawed. That's fine. It's the inconsistency of the rules. Like, so as Stephen says, like, it's, you basically can do whatever you want to somebody in a box if the ball is dead and it's coming in, it's fine. But you can't tap somebody on the shoulder, you know, when they're running through on goal. Not impacted at all. They've decided to throw themselves to the ground, you know, and we can argue as to whether that's a penalty or sending off or so on, right? But it's just like, how is it? It's like, remember the let it flow stuff? That still is going, by the way. People just don't talk about it anymore. You're coming in with lads in midfield, like, cracking into guys, like, you know, completely dangerous, technically getting the ball or whatever, but, like, no need for it. Like, you know what I mean? Absolutely free in any other era of football since 1978, right? But it's just like, oh, they're not frees anymore. But, like, a defender shielding the ball gets, like, you know, a nudge on the arse, goes down flat, always a free, 100% of the time. What's the difference? Why are these things, one group of things are free and one not? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, let them be men. Men's game. It's a man's game again. Graeme Souness is delighted. But only sometimes. Only in certain circumstances. The rest of the time, it's like, oh, yeah, you flopped to the ground. You're getting your free. You're getting your reward for it. And they all know where it is. Like, this is like, it's such nonsense.
It's ugly. It's disgusting. It's puke football on. And I know where the antidote is.
What is?
It's at Daily Mount Park.
Okay. Well, Daily Mount Park, or we've got a text in as well in the Old Firm, potentially, as well.
The Old Firm was so entertaining.
Or the Glasgow Derby, as someone call it.
Just, I just want to go through a few texts before we get there. So James in Waterford has been in touch to say, watching the Premier League yesterday, I have to let you know just how disappointed I am with the state of the game and just how unwatchable I now find it. Two of the league's biggest teams, Arsenal and Chelsea, who have spent billions on players, spent the entire game playing for corners and then pretending to be Hulk Hogan fighting each other in the box. And to top it off, the Palace player got a red card and penalty because he touches an opponent's shoulder. It's a terrible game now. M says, yeah. I may be in the minority of Arsenal fans, but if you don't win either the Premier League or Champions League, in brackets, good draw, I'd sack Arteta. I think City will win the league purely because we are afraid of losing a game rather than going for it. The infamous Donegal-Dublin game was more exciting than yesterday. I do think, objectively speaking, that, you know, being afraid to go for a thing does add an element of nervousness and a bit of drama that we see here every Sunday, every Saturday, whenever Arsenal are playing. Like, I kind of found watching yesterday a little bit like that sort of bleak but oddly compelling game between Ireland and South Africa in rugby at the end of last year, where it was just scrum, 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 Ireland getting pulverised physically, and it was...
That was unique, though, and it was a one-off, and that's why it was interesting. This is now every Arsenal game.
But it's every South Africa game.
But if it's every... Yeah, but we only kind of watch the Ireland matches, let's face it. As a country, as a nation, we only care about the Ireland game.
He's had the quiet bird out loud.
So you're saying that it would be acceptable if this happened once? Like,
it'd be interesting. Seeing something different.
Is that not the same as, like, literally anything? Like, everything gets more boring the more you see it.
Yeah, but this is ugly. Like, I mean, this is, I think it's objectively ugly. And I will say one thing, Owen, and I'm not suggesting that you're being defensive or biased, although...
But I do think this conversation does need a devil's advocate, like, from a journalistic standpoint.
Maybe, but I will say something to you.
It's very one-sided.
I could watch teams that I support, right? And people will say that was a putrid game or whatever. And I don't see it because I'm so invested in the result. It doesn't matter to me whether it's entertaining or not, because the actual scoreline and the outcome is the only thing that matters. If you're watching it as a neutral, you see things differently. And Arsenal are shite to watch.
Yeah.
You know, they just like, are. But we still have to watch. So I get the storyline thing.
Who was saying the opposite?
Well, you're trying to defend it as a spectacle. Not in terms of, like...
Not in the title, in the style of football.
No, but you're saying that the compelling theater, nature of it makes up for it. And I'm saying that when you have to watch it every Sunday at 4:30, eventually you kind of think, oh, this is going to be a long 2 hours. Even though all week I'm interested in the title race. The actual watching of the football has become a chore.
I'll concede, though. I'm not missing a game of it.
There you go.
I'm not missing the game, but I do. It's almost. It's a good hate watch.
Exactly. That's where we are in the world right now.
I wouldn't dare turn it off. Like
hate watching is probably the most we do. Like for 99% hate watching, 1% watching our own teams. That's what football
that's what
is.
Social media
right now.
Is as well.
100%. It fosters this culture as well. I just think Arsenal are the perfect hate watch team.
Yeah.
And there's stakes involved.
He's constrained by fear, though, isn't he, Arteta? Because it's not like, you know, I know we always go back to Alex Ferguson. He was the greatest manager in the Premier League. And the reason his teams were so successful is that they played with a certain amount of, you know, there was risk attached to playing for Manchester United. Like, he would tell his players, like, and Stephen Kenny was the same with Dundalk as well. If his team is winning 1-0, he'd say, go out and beat them 3-0 at half time. You go out and score two more goals, beat them 3-0. Whereas Arteta's kind of like, he's constrained by fear. I think he's so swallowed up by the fact that he may not do it this season, that he's just, if we get a goal ahead, we'll do everything we can just to defend that one goal lead, rather than telling his players, go out there, play some swashbuckling football, score two or three goals and beat the opposition well.
It's funny, my perspective on it from an Arsenal point of view is like, it's difficult, right? They need to get over the line. They need to do it in whatever way is possible. And that's all their fans and the club should want. But it is interesting that the neutrals feel this way, because like, I grew up the son of a Leeds fan from the 1970s, right? And John Giles was a huge presence in all our lives, you know, and like remains so. Like, you know, was on the show up until last year. And we always have that narrative in his head, in our heads about what that Leeds team was. But you know the Brian Clough, you know, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better, that he says to Don Revie, the most amazing television moment of all time. Like, you can understand that a little bit more when you think of this in terms of Arsenal. Arsenal have spent so much money on this team. They have built this squad of very good players.
Very tall players, very good set pieces.
They're big physical players, but there's good footballers in there as well. People who could do more than what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they're not doing it. And I think this Leeds team, this Arsenal team, I'm borrowing on because that Leeds team of the 70s were brilliant. They were probably the best footballing team, and they were known for their physicalness and for everything else. And they were known as Dirty Leeds, and the whole country outside of Leeds hated them, right? I think this is what's happening with Arsenal. This Arsenal team could be just as successful if they played better.
We should get into tonight's news round. As I say, our number is 0879 180 180. If you want to get involved in the conversation, we are starting with League of Ireland action tonight, Steve-O.
Yes, indeed. There's a big game taking place down at Inchicore. Remember, there was a couple of games at the start of the season which were postponed due to those bad conditions. So they've rescheduled St Patrick's Athletic to play against Galway United tonight in Inchicore. Just having a quick look at the teams, there was talk that Franz Piero should feature for Galway United this evening, but he's not in their squad. They're starting with Francesco Lombardo up front alongside David Hurley. St Patrick's Athletic have Rommel Palmer in their team alongside Edmondson up front, and it does look like they're going for a back four with James Brown on the right-hand side of that defence. He had a very good debut in their 4-0 victory over Dundalk on Friday night, and his manager Stephen Kenny was talking about his brand new full-back, James Brown. He feels good.
James is he's had a very good debut. He's a raider, his energy, he raised along the right, and he's great attitude, you know, he's infectious. I'm fortunate enough to have very good defenders. I think we're still coming to terms with the change. I feel there's some pluses and some areas that we can improve for certain, and we've got to look to continue to do that. I think we create a lot of chances today, which is very important.
That game kicks off at 7:45.
Yeah, on to the Premier League then. We have some brilliant audio from Arne Slot.
Yeah, he was conducting his regular pre-match press conference ahead of tomorrow night's meeting with Wolves. He confirmed he will be without Florian Wirtz again after the German pulled up with that back injury during the warm-up before last month's match against Nottingham Forest. The Liverpool boss is speaking at length in relation to the set-piece fad that's dominating English top-flight football this season. He was asked a couple of questions in relation to the fallout from yesterday's match between Arsenal versus Chelsea, which saw a lot of rugby-style tackles during corners. Hasn't been a vintage season for the reigning champions, with Slot complaining a lot about his team coming up against a lot of deep defences, which of course are called these days low blocks. Between that and the set pieces, he's not enjoying it as a spectacle.
Now, first of all, you have to accept. I think it's mainly here in the Premier League. If I watch other leagues, I don't think there's so much emphasis on set pieces. One of the reasons is, and that's sometimes funny for me to do, if I watch a Eredivisie game, which I still do, I see goals being disallowed or falls on goalkeepers being given. I'm like, wow, that's a big difference. Here you can almost hit a goalkeeper in his face and the referee still says, just go on. Do I like it? My football heart doesn't like it. I already said once in this press conference, if you ask me, yeah, then thinking about football, I think about 10, 15 years ago about the Barcelona team. Every Sunday evening, you were hoping that they would play. And now, most of the games I see in the Premier League are not, for me, a joy to watch. But we're not going to change it. So, and maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, things will change again. But what I wouldn't be surprised of, if you go to an under-16 game somewhere, you know, how do you call this, your Sunday League football? We call this amateur football in Holland. I wouldn't be surprised if you see teams completely being focused, 16-year-olds on set pieces.
Yeah, they've just discovered how to win games really comprehensively, Liverpool, and now his manager is bemoaning that very method.
Well, he has been talking about it all season, as Steve said. He doesn't seem to have a filter, or even a self-preservation filter, you would think. Is like, you know, stop telling people what you don't want them to do against you, Arne. But, yeah. I suppose the last 20 minutes would suggest that you're the only one who would disagree with him there.
Maybe this wouldn't be a conversation if everybody was just really bad at set pieces. Is that the whole thing? Like, just be less good at this thing and then this conversation will go away. People will stop complaining about the thing that is leading the way in terms of Premier League themes.
And as well, like, the media hasn't helped here either, because, and I mean, the especially the television broadcast media that are putting these games on television, and putting all the set-piece coaches bang in the middle of these situations. Like, they've all become household names. Keith Andrews, of course, being one. And then got promoted to the head coach of Brentford. Yeah. And his replacement, Stephen Rice, of course.
And tell me, how's he doing, Steve-O?
Stephen Rice or Keith Andrews?
Keith Andrews. Very, very well.
He's doing bloody well.
I mean, Austin McPhee at Villa. He's with Portugal now, actually, with Roberto Martinez, who was in Scotland. I remember when I was at Villa Park at the Juventus game last year, he came, like, there was a free and there was only a couple of minutes left, and he walked basically out onto the pitch and everyone stopped to tell him what, like, as if it was like a, you know, before the shot clock ran out in the NFL. And I just remember, like, I definitely did shout from the very top of the whole den where I couldn't be heard, "Sit back down, you W," right? To which, like, nobody around me seemed to feel the same way. I was like, you've all drank the Kool-Aid here. This is a ridiculous situation. Surely they know what to do. Like, surely he could do his work on the training ground.
Wasn't there earlier this season,
lump the ball into the box, which is what they did.
But like, you're an American football fan. I mean, why? I know it's a different sport. But why would they be giving in-game instructions to their teams in their headsets, talking behind the clipboard?
Absolutely. I just think because football, but the whole idea of football is that it's a flow state.
It's literally not a flow state at set pieces. It is stop start. That is the whole point of set pieces. It is the most controllable thing in football.
It should not be allowed. The idea that a coach should be able to give instructions, a specialised coach, for a free kick, a corner, or a throw in, is a joke, and is completely it's complete antithesis to what football should be about. It's a get on
ban
with
set piece coaches.
Ban them communicating during the game.
You'd have Austin McPhee brought in a laundry basket into Village training.
Well, they should definitely ban them.
Have them. They're absolutely part of the preparation for the game. But I don't agree with them coming out into the coach's box and stopping the game. Stopping, like, waiting to take a set piece longer so that the set piece coach can tell you what to do.
Wasn't there some young Arsenal fans waiting around after a match looking for Nicolas Jover's autograph?
And right too.
Yeah.
What I would do for a Nicolas Jover autograph. Will you skip on to the Everton story here, Steve?
You saw the tactics board there, Nicolas, please. One of those mini tactic boards that Ruben Amorim had in the dugout that time. Sorry.
We have spent quite an amount of time on the football, but it's just important to get an update on Coleman.
Yeah, the club captain for Everton, a notable omission from their bench for the win away to Newcastle in the Premier League at the weekend. However, he should be okay for that the playoff semi-final against the Czech Republic later this month. David Moyes, his club manager, said today the veteran defender picked up a knock in training last week, but it's not too serious.
Right then, on to the big Irish story from a golf perspective over the course of the weekend. Shane Lowry and his really just shocking kind of collapse on hole 16 and 17 in Florida. What have you got for us?
Well, he was visibly emotional on as he stopped to give his post-round interview in Florida last night after the Cognizant Classic finished on the PGA Tour. The Offaly man was in the perfect position to win his first solo American PGA Tour event since the WGC Bridgestone Invitational in 2015. He had that three-shot lead down the stretch before hitting his tee shots into water on 16 and 17 to record back-to-back double bogeys. It allowed Colombia's Nico Echevarria to close out a two-stroke victory on 17 under par. Larry slipped back into a three-way tie for second on 15 under. Not for the first time this year. The 38-year-old double bogeyed the 72nd hole at the Dubai Invitational, which cost him that title last month.
I'm obviously extremely disappointed. I had the tournament in my hands and I threw it away. What more can I say? It's twice this year now so far, so I'm getting good at it, but yeah, look, what can I say? Like, I played unbelievable all day, and then one bad shot in 16 and completely threw me for the last three holes. It's never happened to me before. I said to Darren, I said, how do I feel like this now when I went through what I did and last September in Bethpage, you know, got through that fine, and then, you know, I just felt like it was weird out there. I just really, yeah, just couldn't feel a club face in the last three holes. Then after my tee shot on 16, it was strange. But you know, what can I say? It's very, very disappointing. Jeez, like, this is going to be hard to take. Yeah, Dubai was hard at the start of the year, but this is going to be pretty hard. Yeah, like, I have a tee time next Thursday in Bay Hill, and I have no choice but to move on. The hardest thing about today is I've never won in front of my four-year-old, and she was there waiting for me, and yeah, I only wanted it for her today. I didn't want it for her. I don't care about anything else. Like, I wanted it so bad, just to see her little ginger head running out in the 18 green would have been the most special thing in the world.
It's amazing audio, absolutely gut-wrenching stuff from Shane Lowry there. Obviously the second time this year that he's had a bit of a meltdown late on. Obviously should have won in Dubai in January, should have won yesterday. You guys would have seen the statistic around the 305 consecutive holes without a double bogey. Mm. And then back-to-back double bogeys at 16 and 17. Obviously the Bear Trap has that title for a reason. And it got Shane Lowry yesterday. So just complete collapse, really. 2022, the last time he's won as an individually. He has that title with Rory McIlroy from 2024 as a duo, Ryder Cup heroics as well last year. But this one is clearly something that he's desperate for. There's a chance that it does happen for him in the next couple of weeks. Like, if he is this close,
very well.
Like, it's kind of easy to conflate this with, you know, an inability to get over the line at the moment. But similarly, if he's been in the mix in two pretty commanding positions so far this year, it could easily happen for him in the next month.
Padraig Harrington, before he went on his run of three majors, was he had a rake of second places, didn't he?
Yeah,
I remember that well.
Yeah, double figures,
and he just couldn't get it over the line.
Yeah.
And then, boom, he gets his first major and he went on to get the three in total. So it just goes to show you that, you know, golfers can go to this where they'll just seem to can't get it with these wins over the line. So yeah. I wonder, even would talking to Padraig Harrington maybe even help him a bit? I don't know.
Well, first of all, I thought, like, it's amazing that he gave such an honest interview and didn't try to blah, 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 sort of like, oh yeah, it happens with two tee shots. He completely admitted that it was a head issue once he hit that shot in 16. Which I think is helpful. Because I think if you're going to get over that, you have to confront it, don't you? Like, so, like, this is a guy who has a major championship, is, like, a genuine Ryder Cup hero. Like, the bottle he showed, you know, down the stretch in Bethpage, like, completely swung. I know he actually got the retaining point and they ended up winning it, but it was a complete momentum stopper for America as well. So it's all there, but obviously there's compartmentalization when it comes to the Ryder Cup with him versus when he's representing himself and stuff like that. So I know what you're saying, that, like, you know, it does feel to me that Shane has faded on Sundays in a regular way, maybe not this dramatic for a few years now. And I think this is probably something that he needs to seriously look at, you know, whether it's talking to someone or whatever it might be, because his game is right there. That's the thing. His game is right there. Like, he is just about, he's as good as anyone on his day at the moment.
He must be doing all that, is he?
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe it's darkest before the dawn in that regard then. Mm. He has the worst, manifestation of it, because he's basically got it sorted out almost, you know. Yeah. Who knows?
He's like, a very heart in the sleeve character though as well, isn't he? Like, Harrington is very analytical, you know, he probably looks at these things a bit more coldly, whereas Larry's a proper heart in the sleeve athlete, and that's what makes him so, you know, popular. But I just wonder if he has to step back maybe and just kind of look at this in a more analytical way.
The thing that came to mind for me last night was that this is quite similar to McIlroy at the 2024 US Open, which, after, you know, a multitude of near misses at majors over the course of a decade, that felt like the worst, as if the job was getting more difficult the longer it was taking him to finally get another major. And then two majors later is Augusta last year, and it happens for him. So that's kind of
But almost didn't. You know,
he bottled the Masters and won the Masters.
I wasn't
dismissing
your point. That was actually, I think it's a really good one, because Rory nearly threw that away and had to be in the type of place where he had another chance, and he had the shackles off in the playoff and was able to do it, because that was the only way he could get over the line. And, you know, he won't have that anymore now. And maybe it's the exact same there. Maybe you just need to win, and you need to be in a position where you can make your mistakes, but you've played so well that week that you're gonna do it.
Okay, our number is 0879 180 180 if you want to get in touch on WhatsApp. Loads coming in on Arsenal, which we'll get to between now and 8 o'clock. Remember, we've got Kevin Kilbane with us on the football show after 9. More from Steve-O on this extended news round after the break. Welcome back. Stephen Doyle's extended news round continues. So we've got some new rule changes being implemented soon in hurling.
Yeah, the hurling, its new descent rules will come into effect for the upcoming National League final zone. A motion was strongly backed at Congress to introduce a 30-metre penalty for arguing with officials. The GAA's Director General, Tom Ryan, says they had considered bringing in the rules sooner, but he feels a 28-day period was needed to avoid a short-circuiting the process.
Okay, then we had big statements from the Cork hurlers on and off the pitch at the weekend.
Yeah, indeed. Defending champions Cork have maintained their unbeaten start in Division 1A of the National Hurling League. Alan Walsh, Barry Walsh and Brian Hayes raised green flags as the Rebels made it 4 wins from 4 with a 3-12 to 1-15 victory at Kilkenny. We like this little bit of audio in the office. Cork forward Alan Connolly was speaking after the game to Micheál O'Donnell on TG Carr.
Yeah, and I'm building now for matches, the last few matches of the league. So what would you like to see? I mean, you've blooded an awful lot of new players. You've won all your matches.
Yeah, keep winning, win the league, win Munster and win the All-Ireland. That's our goal. That's what we're going to do.
Love to hear it. thinking about this earlier, how we're necessarily going to have to trot out the same line about Cork repeatedly as this year goes on. Just about the, you know, can Cork win the All-Ireland is going to be an often asked question, and the kind of response to that is, well, maybe. Let's see. Like, will there be anything that you'll see from Cork in the Munster Championship or even in an All-Ireland quarterfinal or semi-final that will convince you they can win the All-Ireland more so than 12 months prior?
No. When you saw last year what Limerick did to Cork in the Munster Championship first round, so it's something equivalent to that, a real blowout of the water, that amounted to nothing. Limerick lost to Dublin 3 or 4 weeks later. You know,
lost the Cork.
Well, true, yeah, and the penalties, like, so, and lost the Clare in the meantime, in a game that, anyway. But that's
My
short answer to that would be no.
But I think there will be an element of us having to judge, you know, 2026 on its own merits. There'll be a doubt, but I think people will certainly get to the point. If Cork win all their games by 10 points, we'll get to the point where we think they can do it. There'll be a doubt that it could happen again, but, like, surely what happened last year in the final is a bit of a freak. And maybe it's a culmination of 20 years of a bigger issue. But, like, that one incident was a freak thing to happen, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't, because then you factor in, I suppose, the massive loss to Limerick. And the crazy, where they should have lost to Clare after leading by 12, 13 points.
Yeah.
Where, like, there's a frailty there. And that's, I suppose, he can be really bullish about it because they have nothing to lose in terms of, like, people will only, like, they have something to lose, obviously, in terms of thing, but, like, in terms of their reputation as a team, they have to win or they'll be forever seen as, I suppose, not living up to their own standards or whatever, their own potential.
But I love that answer. I wish more players would do something. I hope that isn't held against them, because like, what else would they be wanting to do? They won the league last year. They won Munster last year and lost the All-Ireland final. Surely the only thing they could imagine if they were going in and goes, "Oh, sure, we'll go and do our best every day."
Yeah.
Like, be honest. Obviously, you're there to say we're going to win all three titles this year. What else would you be doing? But at the same time, we hear that and we go, "Oh, Jesus." we're all socialized into thinking that GAA players shouldn't be saying anything.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
No, it's true. It's refreshing from Malin Connolly.
Brilliant, yeah. Love to hear it.
In terms of, I think this is the GAA story of the weekend. We knew Congress might have something to it, but Congress became the story of the weekend for them to do with any of the motions that were on the table. I know Peter Canavan probably alluded to the fact that maybe a motion to do with the Allianz question should have been on the clore at the weekend. So huge reaction to Peter Canavan speaking on RT about the Allianz protest and Jarlath's response to all of that on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, there sure was. On the pro-Palestine protesters stormed Croke Park, calling on the GAA to bring an end to Allianz's sponsorship of the National League. The German company's subsidiary, PIMCO, is a large investor in the Israeli government. The continuation of the sponsorship was confirmed in December after an ethics committee was tasked with making a decision. Canavan and several other prominent GAA figures, including Colm O'Rourke and Pat Gilroy, joined the protest, which began on North Circular Road. GAA President Jarlath Burns claimed that a number of volunteers and security staff were injured during the incident. He said, after it happened, "I would urge people within our own association who might have aligned ourselves with some of the people who have come in and illegally occupied our building today and tried to disrupt Congress by assaulting our staff members and the people who are here to protect us, just to examine their own consciences and to work out, are they doing the right thing? Because we went through a process. We have our Congress to go through, and I would not be bullied or intimidated by anybody who would come in here and try to do so. I don't need any lectures about what it's like to feel the pressure of illegal occupation. I don't need any lectures or people shouting in my face about what it's like to go to bed at night fearful that somebody would barge into your bedroom and riddle you with bullets, because that was my lived experience when I was young." So on RT that evening, this is how Canavan responded.
"A lot of what he said, I would echo on that. It does strike a chord, and you go back to when we were younger and to what we had to endure. And, you know, Jarlath spoke about what happened in Donnelly's bar. There was a lot of atrocities went on, and what kept us going was the GAA. We had something to do, something to be part of. And for a lot of us, it was the GAA that saved us. There's thousands of children aren't getting that opportunity." He also referenced, and Jarlath is still sore from something that happened 50 years ago, and rightly so. And he mentioned that there was no convictions on that killing. That was 50 years ago. Why? Because so many people buried their head in the sand, didn't want to know what was going on. The exact same is happening now with us. We've an opportunity as an association to do the right thing, Joanne, just to do. And I have no doubt that if this sponsorship wasn't as big, wasn't as huge in terms of the financial aspect, then I've no doubt that the GAA would have dropped them and said, "We can do without you."
Yeah, just he did obviously mention Donnelly's bar. Oh, just for context, people may be unaware, but of course there was a gun attack on that bar in South Armagh 50 years ago. Well, in fact, it was 50 years ago last year, last December. And people who are related to the victims are still looking for justice there. It's believed they were killed by the loyalist paramilitary UVF unit known as the Glenine Gang.
Yeah, it's something that I thought maybe was going to reach ahead a few months ago. I think this is probably the peak of this story so far. And maybe that's not something that the GAA had actually countenanced, because Jarlath has been speaking about this quite a bit over the past couple of months. I think the Ethics and Integrity Commission's report, that actually went through quite a democratic process. Like, it has to clear Central Council, it has to clear a body which has a member from every single county sitting on it. So all 32 counties are represented on this board that passed this report. And Jarlath himself has to go out and, as president of the association, be the sort of figurehead on this, and has to be the person who then stands over the very democratic decision. So I've got a little bit of sympathy for the situation that Burns finds himself in these situations, because there are arguably more powerful people in the organisation, and yet it's always the president who is the figurehead in all of this.
That's what you sign up for, I suppose.
But like, Peter Canavan, like, it was a really amazing piece of television. And the way in which he vocalised all of that on Saturday evening, and like, this is not going to not move the needle. Like, this is going to be an important moment in this story. And if the GAA doubles down on this, so be it. But it's definitely rattled a few cages, I'd imagine, after Saturday.
Yeah, it was really compelling stuff from Canavan. And I think one of the things is, like, you know, that report, by the way, is, you know, worth reading. And, like, you just see the GAA's perspective on it as well, I have to say, right? But the problem is you can't be dismissive of the protest, and it becomes a lot harder when it isn't just a load of placard-carrying randomers.
It's some GAA of
the
legends.
Biggest names in GAA history, not least Peter Canavan being one of them, but a couple of people on his level were there on Saturday as well. And it's very hard to dismiss then. And actually, I thought, like, you know, the statement that and Steve read out from Jarlett Burns there, I thought was a little bit dismissive, you know, and I just thought the way Canavan turned it back around in that answer when talking to Joanne Cantwell on Saturday night was just unbelievable, unbelievably articulate, but it's really kicked on the conversation, I think.
I think the use of the phrase illegally occupied or illegal occupation by Jarlett Burns, that didn't go down well. I don't think it was yeah. bad taste, I felt anyway.
I don't think it was a useful comparison.
Yeah.
I suppose there's only 3 weekends left of league, and that's including finals. So there's 2 rounds of games left, aren't there, in the final?
And then it moves on to a different sponsor.
Like, is there a chance it just kind of dissipates and becomes something that's kind of there, but, like, loses all momentum?
Yeah.
Until maybe, I suppose, 9 months.
I think as well, and listen, I'm not going to sit here naming names, but they're not the only sponsor that have connections that are involved with the GA, you know, so...
That was a key part of the Ethics and Integrity Commission's report, is to remove the sponsor, you then need to replace the sponsor. And I think Peter Canavan echoes the view of a lot of people that you can go out and there'll be loads of companies that you can go out and actually get who will come in and fulfill this role. But in the view of the commission, that is not the case, given the financial power of Allianz and given the couple of degrees of separation. So then you all of a sudden have to make those jumps of separation in your sort of audit of every potential company that comes in. That's the view of the commission and their report.
And they're fairly adamant that Allianz PLC are not connected to this. So again, we can all have our personal beliefs on what that means, but that is the position that they have taken. And you can understand that if that is their belief or whatever, why would we pander to, you know, what they would maybe see as kind of hysteria? People that are helpless about this awful situation are looking for the GAA to do something, but maybe there is nothing for the GAA to do. That's certainly, I think, how they would feel.
And I think the phrase they would use in the report as well is sibling or cousin company. That's the degree of separation that they feel comfortable with. And that's the conclusion they came to, and they've stuck with it. And as I said at the top, I mean, Jarlett Burns speaks on behalf of the members of the GAA, not all members of the GAA, but certainly in terms of, like, those who's actually worked on this and voted on this and passed this and kind of supported it last December. So that's his standpoint, I guess, after the weekend. But really, really interesting stuff from Peter Canavan there for sure. Where do you want to take us next, Steve-O?
Yeah, just talk about Kobe McDonald again. He has been the chat of the weekend after another weekend of league football. Mayo holding on to beat Armagh at a wet and windy Castlebar. It was a fourth win in the campaign for Mayo, but it didn't come without some drama, of course. They held off a late Armagh surge to win by a single point, and sub Kobe McDonald played a key role. The 18-year-old following up his sensational debut a week earlier with 2 points from play and a number of key assists. After the game, our own Tommy Rooney spoke to Moran, Andy Moran, that is, the manager of Mayo, about the Aussie-bound player.
Kobe's an exceptional player, and like, it's very important that, you know, we treat him like every other player, but we know the talent he has. But I keep saying, similarly to Darragh Byrne has been our top scorer from play right from the offset in the league this year, and he's 19. You know, and there's a cluster of them. Keane, what age are you?
22.
Sean Moran there is 21. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a cluster of them. So Kobe is just part of that. We see him as part of that cluster. We understand the talent he has, but we do understand that we have him for a limited time as well.
Yeah, the other thing is there's 10,000 people in McHale Park. There's a right noise when he's introduced. There's a right noise in the balls in his hand. There is something there that you can capitalise as a team and as a county with somebody as exciting as that.
Oh, 100%. Joe, we've got these players. Like I often said back in my own career, my career was going nowhere in terms of playing. I was 26, 27, and then you have Lee Keegan, Aidan O'Shea and Killian O'Connor to come along nearly all in one burst, and then we take off into our decade of competing. So you're, sometimes these players come in a generation, and sometimes you have to wait for them. So can we capitalise on it? Of course we can. Joe, I know you filled plenty of headlines this week on social media and newspaper. Listen, when a guy comes along like that, it doesn't happen too often. So listen, it is what it is.
Just the last one on that. I think there was a, I don't know where exactly it came from, but there was a line that maybe he's not going to go. Like that
DB,
sort of,
yeah.
That sort of, that I suppose, I know I was asked about it on air as well. Is there a chance he doesn't go? Where are you on that?
Well, like my thing is, I was very fortunate to grow up in a club where we exceptional talent as well in terms of the Handleys were coming through, those three brothers there, Andy, Pearce and Keane. And Pearce and Keane went to Australia. Andy was part of that under 17 Ireland team as well. And Pearce and Keane went. Keane came home and Pearce stayed there forever. So you just don't know. But you have to put the things in place that would make it attractive to them if they want to come home. And that's all we'll do with Kobe. We will absolutely shake that man's hand when he's going out the door and wish him all the best. Because I've mentioned it a few times and Keane will back me up on this. The man comes into training there, you wouldn't even realise he was there until you see him on the field. He's just quiet, humble, just gets on with it.
Yeah, we'll have more on this with Darren O'Sullivan after 8 o'clock when we talk Gaelic football. Steve-O, we should just round up a couple of extra stories here from the day's news. So, Ireland and the rugby squad, we've got an update on who's in, who's out.
Yeah, few additions there on. Bundy Aki, Robbie Henshaw and Jamie O'Brien have been called in ahead of that game against Wales on Friday. Harry Burns won't feature though because he was ruled out due to failing his concussion protocols. Wales have ruled out fly half Sam Coslow for their trip to Dublin on Friday. Luke McGrath, meanwhile, the Leinster veteran scrum half, is joining Perpignan at the end of the season. The French club has confirmed that the Ireland international has agreed a one-year contract with the option of a second year.
They're going to win sort of the Palme d'Or this year, Perpignan, for their, you know, unveiling video of Luke McGrath, which goes on for about 45 minutes on social media, where the entire life story of Luke McGrath is told in really emotional fashion, of him being brought along to Lansdowne Road by his dad. He could feel the stadium creaking beneath him as the roar was going out there, watching this brilliant Perpignan team in Dublin playing against Leinster. And I think, I'm trying paraphrasing here, but his dad said to him that what these Perpignan players are doing is greater than just, you know, the rugby on the pitch. It represents a greater thing. And now he's proud to be part of this greater thing as a Perpignan player. It's great. Like, I mean, I didn't know Luke McGrath to Perpignan would be the thing that would tug at my heartstrings this week. But their social media team.
The rest of your weekend was just watching set pieces.
He's only finished crying over Shane Lowry. Then it was like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's it. I'd completely forgotten about Shane Lowry. Sorry, Luke McGrath, you're back in the second place. Yeah. What have you got next for us?
Yeah, just finished an athletics own because Kate O'Connor smashed her personal best for the 60 metres hurdles at the National Indoor Championships in her first competitive appearance since winning the heptathlon silver at the World Championships last September. O'Connor took on Sarah Lavin in the sprint hurdles at the Sport Ireland Arena. O'Connor came home in 8.21 seconds to win the silver medal, a significant improvement on her previous best of 8.30. In her specialist event, Lavin Julie took the win in 8.07. It's her eighth consecutive indoor title and 19th senior title overall.
Dermot in Dublin says, how worried is Mick about Villa's poor run of form?
Very.
Liverpool win at Wolves tomorrow night puts them out of the top four, missing Tielemans and McGinn big time, plus Watkins' form is gone. I suspect Dermot might be a Villa fan.
And Kamara. Exactly right. But it's about the top five, not the top four. So beat Chelsea tomorrow and they're 9 points clear of them. So.
It all went pear-shaped when McGinn went off that time. That's poor.
Tielemans is the big loss. They can't play against low block teams without Tielemans because they literally have nobody else to play a true ball. But anyway.